Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 34 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is with Arlene Martinez-Vasquez, and I was so excited to sit down with her. I had not heard of this production that's coming up, produced by Thriving Artists. It's called The Passion as Told by Antígona Pérez. It's a play that Arlene translated and then also brought into the present day. So it's sort of Antigone meets social media with a lot of awesome Latino actors. And you're not going to want to miss this production. All tickets are either 15 or 10 bucks. It opens August 14th and runs through the 30th at 12th Avenue Arts. I'm going to have the link to Brown Paper Tickets where you can get your tickets, and you totally should. What else? Lots of awesome theater going on with powerful women behind it. I want to remind y'all that the Zigzag Festival opens at Annex Theater on August 3rd, and that runs for 3 weeks. It's Tuesday and Wednesdays. You're going to see three brand new plays written by local young female playwrights. They've also directed another one of the six pieces and dramaturged a third. And so don't miss that. Go to annextheater.org to get all the details and get your tickets for that. This episode is sponsored by KLM XYZ Creative Communications for all your marketing and graphic design needs. Please visit klmxyz.com. All right, enjoy episode 34 with Arlene Martinez-Vasquez. I'm very pleased to welcome Arlene Martinez-Vasquez to the podcast. Welcome, Arlene.
Thank you.
So you have this really exciting project coming up, and you translated it? Is that correct?
Yes, I translated
Tell
it
me
from
all
Spanish.
About the project.
So it's The Passion as Told by Antígona Pérez, and it is a 1968 play written by one of the most important Puerto Rican playwrights, Luis Rafael Sanchez. So it's required reading in university.
Sure.
And from the minute I read it, I just fell in love with the text. And as I was assisting for the Intiman Theater Festival in 2013.
For Trouble in Mind, right?
Yes, for Trouble
Valerie
in Mind.
Newton,
exactly.
Love her.
Yes. She's very wise, very amazing. So I was assisting her, and I was just so jealous of her that she was getting to direct, and I was just like taking notes. So I just kind of decided, well, I'm just going to start a professional project here in Seattle. And I went back to all these plays that you read and you say, one day I'm going to direct this. So I just went back to them. And out of all the ones I read, The Passion as Told by Antígona Pérez is the one that rang the most relevant right now. And I felt it was the story that Seattle needed to hear the most. So I started translating it. It was translated in 1972. But it was only published once and never published again, and the author didn't have the translation, so I had to start from scratch. And I asked for permission to update the play, because what Luis Rafael Sanchez does is, because it was written in 1968, he sets the myth of Antígona in a Latin American dictatorship, nondescript
sure.
Latin American dictatorship, and he takes the Greek chorus and splits it in two. It's a chorus of news reporters and a chorus of the crowd reacting to what the news reporters are saying. So I asked him for permission to, backtracking. So when these news reporters speak in the play, they relate what's going on with Antígona from the dictator's point of view, and they also insert news that were relevant in 1968. So that's when I decided to ask him to update it so we can insert news that are relevant to 2015. And then instead of doing printed press, we're doing online media. So we're recording these multicultural news reporters to talk about this acute perception that we're all getting when we're living through Facebook and social media. So.
And now, I mean, it just sounds incredibly relevant and dynamic, because now when there are news stories where, I mean, anyone with a smartphone and a Twitter feed is a reporter on the street, right?
Exactly, absolutely.
What was that? What is the process like for you? Have you translated a script before?
Yes, I have.
So you have a blueprint that you're following.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your writing process like? Would you sit down for, okay, I'm going to knock out 4 hours here, or is it very
Ooh.
Much as you had time, or?
I take it very slowly. I don't like to force myself to just say, like, I'm going to do 20 pages today. This play, I started translating in October 2013, and I finished it around February 2014. So just, like, in the evening, I'm going to do one scene today, three pages. This play is particularly difficult to translate because it is very poetic. A lot of the actors who have experience with Shakespeare has said that this is the most difficult play they've ever had to memorize. It is very poetic. So it is a real challenge to keep the poetry and make it good English at the same time. So, yeah. And then, but basically, I kind of do a rough translation. I get a lot of proofreading from native English speakers and some bilingual people who understand what it is meant to be saying. And a lot of it then gets fixed in the rehearsal room when actors really delve into it and say, this makes no sense whatsoever. What am I meant to be saying here? You know, and a lot of prepositions get changed. But yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
So talk to me about the process of casting. Did you know, did you hold open auditions? Did you know the artists that you wanted to work with?
I did know the artists that I wanted to work with. It's a very large cast play. It has five news reporters, nine ensemble actors. There's six main characters. The playwright suggests a crowd of 200 heads, but I could only afford three extra heads. So we have a cast of nine. But it is a large cast play, and it was very important to me that all the actors playing these main characters were Latino, because it is such a Latino play. It has nothing to do with being Latino, but it is told from a Latino perspective. If you don't understand Spanish, the language just becomes harder. Like, you just have to be Latino to tell this story. So before anything, I said, okay, are there nine Latino actors in Seattle that could pull this off? And I made a list. And some of them, you know, were surprises along the way that I found. But for the most part, I didn't know who I wanted to work with. And I did a private stage reading of it back in October last year. And with that, I called most of the actors that I knew I wanted to work with, and that was kind of my very mischievous way of auditioning actors, without them knowing they were auditioning. I guess now they know. But yes.
So when how long have you been in rehearsals for this?
We started on May 19th.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and we've been rehearsing 12 hours a week, two evenings and one full weekend day. It's been a longer process than most.
What is your philosophy as a director? What is your rehearsal room look like?
Ooh, that is a great question, because I'm in the midst of really pondering what that's about. But I am a very collaborative director. I really hate about directing the fact that you're meant to have all the answers in the room. That freaks me out. Like, I just want to do this play. So I really like to work with actors who are thinkers, who are creative. Like, I will work 700 times more with an actor who will question my decisions than with an actor that will just do whatever I say. I'm a very collaborative director that way. I also firmly believe that the process needs to be fun. Like, the minute I stop having fun doing theater, I will just stop doing theater. So I do silly games. I do silly warm-ups. I have my little closing ritual where we thank each other for being there at the end of every rehearsal. So to me, like, that sense of family and ensemble is really important, because if you hate the people that you're doing the work with, then it's just not going to happen.
Right, absolutely.
Theater is hard enough, so we just need to make it easy with each other. So that's my philosophy.
How did you decide upon the 12th Avenue art space?
It was a huge strike of luck. When I first started envisioning this project, I actually envisioned it for Burien Actors Theater, because they have a great Latino population that will be very interested in this play. And for many, many different reasons, I found myself looking for another venue. And I looked at the call for proposals for 12th Avenue. It was not even open when I wrote this proposal for them. And I think they don't know. Well, I think they do, because they've started raising the price. But it was by far one of the most affordable spaces in Seattle with what they offer. Like, they offer 5 weeks of unrestricted access to the space. And a lot of theaters I looked at, like just doing 2-3 weeks of performances would come up to $3,000. And if you want one take, you need to pay the tech guy and you need to pay the equity fee. And if you want to come in a Sunday, then you need to pay extra to unlock the door. And there's an evening show, so you need to get out, you know? So it was a strike of luck. It really was.
So fantastic. I love that space. It's
wonderful.
I think some very, very special things are happening there.
Yes, it definitely has created a huge buzz for Seattle Theater. Like, people are just jumping in, and we're sharing the space with Porkfield, who's opening and running exactly the same time as us. And, we already had our little meeting about sharing the space. We're sharing little opening night cookies and drink for our audience.
It's fantastic.
So it's really, I think it's really making the community buzz. And it's a really, really friendly community, so... It's really cool. I'm excited.
Speaking of opening night.
Yeah.
The show opens August 14th.
Yes.
And it runs through the 30th.
Yes.
What's the best place for people to get more information and tickets?
Tickets, Brown Paper Tickets. And you can just put antigonaperez.brownpapertickets.com. Or you can just search it. And for more information about the play, you can also go to the Thriving Artists website, which is www.thrivingartists.org.
We'll have that in the episode description. I was exploring that website a little bit. Talk about this really fantastic philosophy behind thriving artists.
Well, in all transparency, Thriving Artists is very much a premature baby. Again, when I conceived this play, it was not even meant to be a thriving artist play, and it just worked out that I needed a company, and I have this in my head, so why not start using it? But it is a very long-term dream of mine. And it is basically, for many years as a theater director, I've been asking myself, how can theater thrive in a capitalist society? There's so many problems with theater, right? It's like ticket prices are unaffordable for a lot of people. Ticket prices do not cover the cost of making a play.
Nope.
Artists are the first thing to get cut out of the budget. Then... A lot of theaters are trying to do what movies do way better. So I'm just really asking myself that question, and I don't yet have the answer. But the step I'm going to take at it is to have an organization that also has a for-profit business. And I'm not telling you what a for-profit business is yet.
Okay.
Because I really need to figure that one out. But after this play, the next step for Thriving Artists would be to figure out the for-profit business of it. So this for-profit business would donate all the profit to this theater company. And this theater company, the way I envision it, and it's probably not even possible, is that it would work like a ballet theater company where we would have full-time artists on staff. They would get vacation, health insurance, benefits, and they would spend their like 9 till 6 doing extended training in their craft and rehearsing new shows and then performing. So it's completely crazy.
I love it, though, because I think it starts a really important dialogue about we don't all have to accept that we're starving artists.
Not at all.
Right?
I refuse.
That's not sustainable.
It's not. It's not. And so many fabulous artists end up quitting altogether. Like, not even the ones who go to New York to actually make a living doing musicals, but the ones who just quit, who say, forget it, I'm just going to become an engineer now. And it's really sad for the profession. And I just think... I think there's a lot of wonderful initiatives out there trying to solve this same problem. But to me, it's more like if we live in a capitalist society, then let's just use capitalism to help the arts.
I love it.
I mean, organizations all the time create needs for things, right? Like a couple of years ago, no one needed a cell phone.
Right.
When I was in school, I did not need a cell phone. I was freaked out the first time people told me, oh, now you can have a cell phone. I have my pager. Why do I need a cell phone? Such created needs. So how can we create a need for theater? There has to be a way.
I love it. I love it. We're starting. You heard it here first, folks.
Yes, you did. Yes. I have not talked to a lot of people about this because it's completely crazy.
But I love it. Little by little. I think it's... I would switch out the word crazy with progressive and visionary.
Visionary. I like that.
Let's say that.
Let's say visionary.
I was talking last week, just last week with Kathy Shea about the popularity of sex in Seattle and how a lot of the audience members were Asian American people who didn't see themselves on stage.
Yes.
And hadn't seen theater before, and that was the reason that they went. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the motivation behind this piece as well.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, I was a member of Ese Teatro from its conception to 2013. And with Ese Teatro, I did a stage reading of Passport, which is a Venezuelan play. And we did it at ACT. That was the first Ese Teatro show they did at ACT. And then we took it to Burien. And in Burien, we had like 20 audience members who had never been to the theater before. And you could tell because they were dying to sign the mailing list. They were like, you need to sign the mailing list. They're like, oh, you've never been to the theater. That's great. Sign it. But you know what? Like at the end, we did a talk back.
Sure.
And this beautiful woman, this character gets tortured because he has no papers. Some characters spoke English, some characters spoke Spanish to highlight that conflict of really not understanding each other. And this woman says, when I saw this, I had never been to the theater before she started. And she said, when I saw this character, when they bandage, like, cover his eyes, and when they cover his mouth, I saw myself on stage, and I thought, finally, someone knows I'm here.
And how powerful that is.
It still gives me goosebumps. It's like the most beautiful thing anybody could ever say about anything I've ever done, you know? So, yes, I think as well, on the national level, I'm a member of the National Association of Latino Arts and Cultures. At the national level, there's a huge conversation about the role of Latino theater in American theater. How Latino theater is not even Latino theater anymore. It is part of American theater in so many ways. So I really wanted to tell this story because it has this Latino representation, and it also is a universal story. It's not a Latino story about being Latino or being immigrant or not speaking English, which all of them have great value, and of course they should be told. But this particular story is a completely universal story, told in crazy poetic language that could only be written in Spanish to start with, and told with that sensibility. So I think that's really important, to have a reflection of Latinidad that rings more universal, you know, to break that mold that for it to be universal, it needs to be white. Like, it can be Latin and it can be universal. And as part of that, we had a generous grant from from the Seattle Foundation, Neighbor to Neighbor program. So thanks to that grant, we're going to take this play to White Center. And we're going to go to the Evergreen campus, has a 52% Latino population.
Wow.
So we're going to do a 3-day show for the students and 1-evening shows for the communities. And we're already working with the White Center Community Association and the Highland School District to really make sure that we're reaching that population. So it's important for the Capitol Hill theater goers to see this story, and it's important for the Latino people with no theater access to see this story. That theater hasn't been used in 8 years. They have no theater program in this school.
Wow.
It's heartbreaking. So I'm excited. I couldn't be more excited. And then the play is going to start an 8-week drama residency after school for the students to learn the skills to put on a show.
That's amazing. Exciting.
Right?
I'm that very excited. Needs to happen in more. Well, I just remember I grew up in the Midwest, and I did a tour, you know, as 2 actors in the fairy tale in the back of your truck. And some of these kids, it was the only theater that they got the entire year.
Yes.
The entire year. And how sometimes we take for granted. You know, I you know, went to a high school where we had a big musical every year, and not everyone has that.
Not at all. Not at all. It's yeah. And it's a huge responsibility, because in Puerto Rico, I remember, I actually didn't like the theater for a very long time. Because the plays they took me to see as a child were so bad.
What were you watching growing up?
They were these children's stories with the typical, like, he's behind you. And I remember being 5 and thinking, like, he doesn't know he's behind him. Like, why is he so stupid? Like, I felt like I was treated like an idiot as a child.
It was
so
condescending.
Absolutely. So I think it is important to make the effort to go to schools and to also really honor that responsibility. You know, like, if the first show you see you hate it, you're probably going to think all theater is the same and never go again. So that's not true.
Let's dig into that for you. Obviously, you didn't do that. Was there... Do you think that was something inside yourself, inside your personality, where you're like, I need to fix... I'm seeing this stuff I don't like, even as a little kid. Like, I want to fix that. I want to make stuff that people do want to watch.
I don't remember thinking that at all. I remember not liking theater at all. Then I remember doing a very terrible drama class at my school. I went to a tiny school in Puerto Rico. I went to the same school from first grade till 12th grade.
Oh, wow.
And it only had 2 classrooms per grade. So it's like a tiny school run by nuns. It's like very different from the schools here in Seattle. And I did this very terrible drama class, but I enjoyed it a lot. And then it was in university. I went to university for... I started in PR. Communications.
Sure.
But the first year is general studies, right? So everybody does the same thing. And then I realized that arts was what excited me, you know, what I could read more of without having to be assigned to it,
It didn't feel like work.
Exactly. So then I switched to humanities and I started with literature and then I added theater and then I added foreign languages. So I ended up staying in my BA for a very long time. But unlike the U.S., in Puerto Rico, I used to pay $400 a semester.
Oh, my God.
For my BA. So
it was okay. You could just draw out for forever.
So. Right? And it's not like I had a job waiting for me with my degree in humanities, so it's fine. I enjoyed it.
Where do you go? Were there memorable productions for you in college? Like, were you just directing or were you acting then? Or
it's a general theater degree.
Okay.
So we did acting, dance, makeup, scenic design, all of that. But I did discover directing in my acting class because I remember we were doing this open dialogue project where you had to perform the same open dialogue with 3 different circumstances. And I did mine, and then I'm just walking down the hallway and I see that this other pair of people were kind of struggling with it. So I was like, okay, so can I see what you've got? And I kind of directed them, and they were really happy, and we were all really happy with it. And when they presented, the teacher cried. Like, the teacher was like, oh, that is the most beautiful thing I've seen this year. It was like, I was like, oh, maybe this is my calling. Because I knew I was not a very good actor. I tried really hard, but it was not working for me.
It was not for you.
So I was like, oh, maybe this is my calling. Yes, and then I did, in the directing class, that was a huge step for me. And my directing teacher gave me so much encouragement. In the final project, his words were like, the thing with Arlene's pieces is that you can see the joy and the love that she puts when she directs them. He's like, thank you. So from there, I went for a master's degree in directing.
Oh, where did you go?
To London.
Sorry, again, this is an audio medium. I do this often where I react with my hands or whatever, and you can't, you listeners can't see that. Tell me about your trajectory. How did you get from Puerto Rico to London? What was it like in London studying there, where it's just sort of, I've had the privilege of going there once to see a bunch of theater at the National and stuff. And it's just, it's a city that breathes theater. It just has it in its essence. Tell me everything.
Well, when I finished my degree in Puerto Rico, I wanted to come to the United States because that's the path, right?
Sure.
And a lot of the schools here in the United States, you probably know, they take between 2 to 5 students a year for master's degree in directing.
If that,
exactly.
Sometimes it's 2 people every 3 years.
Exactly. So I got shortlisted for Boston. So like literally my application was number 5 or 6.
Wow.
And I didn't make it in. So then as I was crying, thinking, oh, my life is not going to go anywhere. My boss at that time tells me, Arlene, the world is not the United States. There's many other places where you can go for a theater degree. And then talking to advisors, if you go to London, it's the best play for many reasons, but also because it's a transferable degree. Like if you go to Spain or to other places in Europe, they're not transferable. So I found this amazing program in London where you would do 1 class at a time. which fitted me very, very well. So the class was like 10 to 5, and you would focus in this one class for like a month or 6 weeks.
Wow.
And then do the next one. And that fitted me really well. And on top of that, they had these international partnerships. So we went for a month to Moscow to study Meyer-Holtzman biomechanics, which was insane. And then we went for a month to Bali to study Theater of the East. So once I found that program, I was like, okay, this is it. And then I learned that I could use the student loans I was going to use for the U.S. to go to London. And it was pretty much the same cost. So then I went and I did my master's degree there, which was unbelievable.
What school was it?
Middlesex University.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And now the program has moved to Essex University. We were like a small class of very international people. There were not more than two people from the same country. So right now I have friends in Thailand, in Cyprus, in in Romania, in Turkey, you know, and we all stay in touch. So we became family very quickly because none of us had anything better to do with our lives in London.
Right.
So yeah, and then you get to learn so much. Like if you are doing a Commedia dell'arte class, for example, you see how different the body language of a Japanese person is from the Puerto Rican person, from the European person, you know? So it was super interesting, super interesting. And then you get to see all this theater all the time for like £5, and it blows your mind. Some of the best plays I've ever seen in my life, I saw them there on top of a pub for £5.
Wow.
It's just really groundbreaking. And then it's really beautiful to see the progression. A lot of the people who were directing on top of the pub when I was there are now at the Young Vic and at the Barbican in the National Theater Studio. So there is a true progression in the career in London, which I kind of miss. I'm not sure it exists here in Seattle.
It's an interesting landscape, that's for sure.
It was a wonderful time. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, since you had I guess members of your cohort that were from mm-hmm. different, you talked a little bit about different body language, mm-hmm. but what was it like, the convergence of all these different philosophies and training of theater in one place? Would people butt heads? Would you learn from each other? What was that like?
All of it. Yes. We butt heads a lot and we learn from each other a lot. I don't know exactly what to say about this, but yeah, for example, there were some moments they would bring professional actors for us to work with, and there were some moments where the Asian directors would like working these actors really hard, like, and now you're going to be crawling, and this older actress was like obviously having knee problems, but she never stopped to ask her if she was having knee problems, and right. We were like, hey, you might want to ask her. You know, so like these different expectations of what actors can do, and
the etiquette, not necessarily the philosophy you're bringing, but just the etiquette, just the interaction.
Absolutely. And then, the language. There were people in my program whose English was way more broken than mine at the time. And it was interesting. Studying Beckett in England was mind-blowing.
Right?
So this is what this is about. No, I get it.
Beckett doesn't make sense for native English speakers. And then,
it's wonderful. Wow. And my professor actually knew Samuel Beckett. So it was an interesting professor. Like, I'm sorry to tell you, my dear, but you are wrong. Like, okay, I should have known. Tell me. But yeah, it was definitely interesting.
So when your time there comes to an end, how mm-hmm. do you make it from London to Seattle?
I got in a relationship in London, as it happens, just as my visa was expiring. And it turns out this person, who's now my husband, is a dual citizen. So we agreed that I would renew my visa, like 2 months into the relationship. We agreed that I would spend £400, i.e. $800, in applying for a new visa so I could stay for one more year. And that then when that would end, we would both move to America because he had an American passport. And he has family here in Seattle. So when he first told me about Seattle, I didn't even know where it was in the map. So I'm like, I'm not directing Shakespeare and Tennessee Williams. It better be good theater there. And I love Shakespeare and Tennessee Williams. It's just not my aesthetic. So then we came, and I remember we saw Life Girls, Quickies, a Life Girls Quickies show.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I can get behind this. You know, it was like grassroots, fun, unexpected, unpretentious. Absolutely. It was cool. It was cool. So I said, okay, I can see myself in this theater community. And I love the city. It's one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been in my life. So beautiful. So then we moved here. And his family were really great. They actually, his aunt got me my first theater jobs here. She got me to be a director for this yearly school musical at St. Matthew School.
All right.
And that was wonderful. Those kids were unbelievable. And then she also introduced me to Stone Soup Theater, and then I became the location director there for 4.5 years. I kind of just left last year. So, yeah. So when I came, it was very much about proving that I could make a living out of my degree. Because that obviously did not happen in London, and London right. is a very harsh city to live in. So I was like, I'm not getting a part-time job, because once you do that, you stop having time to actually apply for jobs.
Right.
So
right.
I'm going to do theater. So I did. I worked as nonstop as a teaching artist for the last 5 years, and directed a lot of beautiful kids' shows that made me very happy to do. And now I'm kind of going back to, okay, now I want to, you know, like the kids' shows are wonderful and they're so much fun. They're not necessarily the stories I'm dying to tell, right? It's like, the world needs to see You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
Right.
It's fun. It's great. But I want to now go back to tell the stories I actually want to tell.
So tell me about the stories you want to tell. What's on your bucket list?
Ooh, so many. In my bucket list, Venus by Susan Laurie Parks. Yes. Motherfucker with a Hat, which Wet is directing. And I hope it's wonderful. but Motherfucker with a Hat is a wonderful one. Mr. Marmalade, I would love to direct Mr. Marmalade. I would love to direct Psychosis by Sarah Kane.
Oh my God, it's a stunning play.
It's amazing, yes. So there you go. It's really socially relevant theater. I'm not a big fan of comedies. Perhaps I need to work on that. So people don't think thriving artists is ability to go and be depressed. But
I think it's interesting, isn't it, though? I just finished directing The Pillow Man, which is a very dark play.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time, again, it's, you collect these plays as a director, right? That mm-hmm. you want to direct, and it's not, it just, each play has to have its special timing, right?
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
The right time, mm-hmm. the right play. And so it just happened to be this year, this play. And it was the first, it was a little hard for me because it was the first time that I had so many people tell me they weren't going to see it mm-hmm. ahead of it even opening. And I think for them it was like, it's very dark, you know, mm-hmm. it talks about child murders. Mm-hmm. I understand. But, and I think each of the people by themselves were trying to be polite and trying yeah. to have good etiquette. But yeah. being on the receiving end of like a dozen of your friends saying, mm-hmm. not going to come see it. And then balancing that with the passion of wanting to tell the story, even mm-hmm. the hard stories. And
mm-hmm.
theater, yes, is escapism mm-hmm. sometimes.
Yes.
And sometimes you do want to see a good Neil Simon
Absolutely.
Play or mm-hmm. musicals, mm-hmm. all of that. But then I think it's our responsibility as theater artists to tell the stories that are harder to tell as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
And to create dialogue and, you know, what does it mean to be human?
Mm-hmm.
All
mm-hmm.
of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't really a question, but it's just to say, I hear you. I know where you're coming from. I get yes. it.
Yes. Well, there's this beautiful Ecuadorian writer, Aristides Vargas, and he has quite a few plays that I would love to direct one day. And they are very moving and socially relevant, and they're also very funny. I would need to translate them again. So we'll see how. And they're also, you know, jokes that work in Spanish will not necessarily work in English.
Right.
So I really need to think about those ones. But yes, it's got beautiful ones. One, it's called The Age of the Prune, which is about this group of women who make, oh, The Age of the Plum, not prune, plum, because they make plum wine. not prune wine. So this group of women who make plum wine, and it's when the mother of these two sisters is about to die, they start exchanging letters. And in those letters, they start telling the stories of all the women in their family.
Right.
So it really shows like the female oppression and burden and all the things we pass from generation to generation, you know? all these expectations and restrictions. It's wonderful. It is, and it's also really funny. It sounds dark, but it's very funny. So, yeah, there's also that huge list of Latin American theater I would love to direct. But that requires a lot of translation, so we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see.
You get the for-profit business going. Maybe you can hire someone to translate for you, huh? And then you can just be the director. Maybe.
I actually do enjoy the translating.
Oh, good.
I do, yeah. It is actually very exciting to be able to share a play that if I hadn't translated it, then people wouldn't know. Like, that is amazing. I love that. It's just a lot of work, and there's so many things to be done.
And that must deepen your connection with the text, right?
Yes, absolutely. I know the Antígona Pérez by heart. Like, the actors miss a line, and I don't even have the script.
You're like,
open, and I'm like, it's this word, it's not that word. You jump, what? You jump 5 lines. Did they jump? Yes, they jumped. So go back. Know it by heart, yes.
That's amazing. What, I like to ask guests what advice mm-hmm. they have. For, mm-hmm. So what advice would you have for aspiring directors?
I think really know why it is that you want to direct and really invest energy in what it is that you want to say. I think a lot of us do this because we love it and we don't know how to do anything else. I think like right. that is a common thing. I don't think that's a good enough reason to do theater. I'm sorry. I don't think it is. You know, I think like be really aware of your responsibility as an artist and know what it is that you're communicating with every single thing that you do. And I think if you have that, to me, then everything becomes easier. Then you can deal with rejection easier. Then you are not jumping at every single silly opportunity that comes your way just because you want to get your hands on something. Like, it just gives you a focus and a purpose. So
I think that's great advice. It sort of reminds me that, I forget what training or meeting it was, but having someone saying you should have a mission statement for your life.
Absolutely, yes.
You sort of got like a mission statement for only nonprofits have missions. What are you talking about? But I think, you know, you can have that for your life, and you can have that for different genres that you work in as an artist. Like what?
Yeah. Well, and I actually did a training recently where the facilitator was telling us to do a vision statement for our life. Like, what is the perfect version of ourselves that we would like to achieve and to get in connection with that higher self that we're never going to get there, because that's what visions are for, right? You never get there, but it just gives you something to measure yourself against and something to strive for and to move forward every day. So, yeah, why not? I think it's important.
I think that's a great place to wrap up the interview. Creating a vision. Listeners, you're going to create a vision for yourself as an artist, and you're going to create a vision for yourself as a human being.
Yes.
That's your homework, which shouldn't hopefully feel like homework at all. Okay. So people are going to want to visit thrivingartists.org and Brown Paper Tickets. We'll have all the information in the episode description.
That'd be great.
The play runs the 14th through the 30th at 12th Avenue Arts.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Arlene, for being on the podcast. You've been an amazing guest.
Thank you so much. It was fun. Thank you.